As you heard from Melissa Ingles in the WPR News this morning, Governor Evers signed a two-year, more than $87 billion state budget on Thursday that will begin later this month. It includes a more than $2 billion tax cut supported by Republicans. The governor used his veto pen to make 50 changes to the budget, though most of those were relatively minor. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent, and in no way does this appear to be a new era of bipartisanship, as the budget deal arrived along with the fairly standard partisan criticisms we've come to expect. So what questions do you have about Wisconsin's revenue and spending plans over these next 2 years? Would you like to speak on behalf of Republicans or Democrats this morning? And what do you think of Wisconsin's process for budgeting? 1-800-642-1234 to join us. You can always email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Patrick Marley, state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Let's run down some of the highlights of the budget that was signed. Or let's start with the vetoes, actually. What didn't make it into the budget that the Republicans were calling for, Patrick?
You know, in the grand scheme of things, the vetoes were really minor this time. Governors in Wisconsin have pretty broad veto authority, but the governor didn't exercise it much. I mean, they're constrained by what's in the budget, right? They can only take things out. They can't really put things back in unless they get extremely creative. So, you know, the governor didn't like aspects of the budget, but there wasn't really much he could do with his veto pen to address those. So, you know, despite the 50 vetoes, it's really a large-scale acceptance of what the Republicans passed.
The governor didn't use his veto powers this time to increase funding for K through 12 schools. Is that part of the power of the veto pen as you see it, Patrick?
Absolutely. So the governor's veto powers are unusual in Wisconsin because they can strike out individual words. It's not just, you know, a full section, but individual words. So in 2019, the governor was able to find a way to sort of string together some phrases and words to get another $65 million for schools. Republicans learned from that and were more careful about the way they phrased things and, you know, what order they put words in the budget. So he didn't see a chance to do that. There was also a lawsuit over his previous vetoes, not the school one, but other vetoes that he passed. And the Supreme Court, which for decades has been very deferential to the governor's veto powers, hemmed him in a little bit. And so it was unclear exactly what the rules were for this budget, but it was clear that they were more strict than they'd been in the past. So I would say Evers did not really test the grounds on that as to how far that Supreme Court ruling limits him.
Patrick Marley, the governor also vetoed doubling how much money would be transferred to the state's tax-funded operating budget for transportation. Why did he veto that?
So the transportation fund is mostly funded with gas taxes and vehicle fees. And it's has had a transfer for some time of a small amount of the money that's paid with sales tax and income tax. And so Republicans wanted to increase that from 0.25% to half a percentage point and to have that go on permanently forevermore. The governor vetoed it so that would be a temporary change. We'd put in a little more money from sales tax and income tax for a short period of time. The rationale for that, he said, is that the transportation fund should be funded with fees specifically related to transportation and not having general taxes sort of help prop it up.
The governor vetoed sending $550 million to the state's rainy day fund, so the money remains available for spending on, well, in the general fund. Here is Governor Evers' comments after signing the budget with some criticism for Republicans.
They could have done the right thing. They still can do the right thing. There is money left in the state coffers that can be used for schools and other issues. So I'm very hopeful that they'll spend some time thinking through this instead of just going home and spending the rest of the summer enjoying themselves. There's work to be done.
The governor alluded to other ways for funding education in Wisconsin after signing the budget last week, didn't he, Patrick?
Yes. So the veto he did for the rainy day fund is really symbolic more than anything. He's preventing $550 million from getting into that fund, but it essentially, because there's no way to spend it, at least by the governor on his own, it sits in a different savings account. So the effect is the same on the state's bottom line. We just have money sitting in one account instead of another. It does give him a rhetorical advantage to make the case that we have this money sitting in our checking account, essentially, and that we could spend it. He wanted to spend far more on education than Republicans did. He wanted to spend more than $1 billion increased funding for K-12. The Republicans gave him about $128 million specifically that could be spent on education. And so, you know, I think you'll continue to see him as he runs for re-election say this money's sitting there. We should pass a bill right now. We could give schools even more money than we have.
Patrick Marley is a state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Taking your questions this morning, what do you think of Republicans and Democrats' proposals for state spending and fundraising? What are your top priorities? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation, where Jimmy from Valley Junction is standing by. Jimmy, you're on the air.
Morning. Yeah, I just heard on the news about a possible loan program to purchase some paper mills, and the Republicans wanted some money for that, but yet they're cutting taxes by $2 billion. So, you know, are they really serious about this loan thing, or is this just another political stunt to make Evers look bad, or similar to the Foxconn con that little Scotty and his buddy Trump pulled off right before the election?
Jimmy, I'm going to ask Patrick here about the mill bill and where that stands. Patrick?
So the how to deal with the closed mills in Wisconsin Rapids and Park Falls has become a little bit of a political hot potato. The governor had a bill that would have expanded Medicaid, and then that would have brought the state more federal money, used that to spend on a number of priorities that Republicans like, including taking care of that mill. Republicans didn't take up that bill because they've long opposed the expansion of Medicaid under Obamacare. And the Republicans then passed their own bill to do essentially the same thing, get those mills or give loans to get those mills. But that would have used federal COVID stimulus money. Evers on Thursday vetoed that bill because he says it's unclear that the state could use the COVID money for that. And, you know, if that were to happen, then the state would have to pick up those costs. So what you have is, you know, both parties say that they want to help those mills and find a way to get those jobs, but in total disagreement about how to do it. And the two parties very rarely talk. So it's hard to see at the moment how progress could be made there.
As far as the budget goes, there were some criticisms on both sides, and I wanted to hear State Representative Mark Bourne, who co-chairs the legislators' budget writing committee, as he responds to Governor Evers signing the budget last Thursday.
Personally, I find it laughable and hypocritical that just 6 months ago, when Governor Evers introduced his budget and they proposed an over $1 billion tax increase, he was given the opportunity to lead and propose tax cuts for the hardworking families of Wisconsin, and he failed.
Patrick, the Republican leadership in the legislature said just about the same thing in reaction to the state budget, calling it the most conservative budget in a generation.
They did call it that. Both Speaker Voss and the Senate Majority Leader Devin Leahy called it that, which is a pretty surprising thing given that, you know, for 8 years, Republicans controlled all the state government. They expanded school choice programs with the budget. They implemented parts of Act 10 with that. They put drug testing requirements in for some public benefits programs. So to call this budget the most conservative in a generation, it was a little bit of a surprise. The reason they're calling it that is because it's got this very large income tax cut, about $2 billion, more than $2 billion. And then it's also got a property tax cut of about $600 million. So the Republicans are happy that their version of the budget got through. They're bothered that Evers is now claiming credit for those tax cuts because he's the one who signed them. So I think you're going to hear a lot of political noise about who deserves the credit for those tax cuts.
Well, does this just set the scene for elections next year and how both parties are trying to carve out their niche and what they want to take credit for in this budget?
Absolutely. You'll see a lot of talk about this in that, you know, the governor made clear from the moment he signed the budget that he's going to be campaigning on this tax cut as part of the things that he's raising. He's done. It takes away whoever his Republican opponent may be. It takes away an issue for them. You know, had he vetoed that tax cut, you would have heard a lot about that from Republicans. Now the candidates for governor are going to have to find ways to criticize Evers, but they'll have difficulty criticizing the budget he signed because other Republicans are calling it the most conservative in a generation.
The Republican leadership in the state legislature. Patrick Marley is a state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And now we pivot to Lincoln Hills and what's next for our youth prisons with Copper Lake. Now that the deadlines for their closure have come and gone. The reporter who broke the story is our guest, and we will get the very latest from him next, as well as from you at 1-800-642-1234. You're listening to the State Capitol Report. I'm Lee Rayburn on The Morning Show, and this is the Ideas Network. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and it was back in the spring of 2018 when then-Governor Scott Walker signed into law a plan to close the Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake youth prisons by January of this year. The idea, in theory, was to keep incarcerated kids closer to their families. Then in 2019, Governor Evers moved that deadline back to July, and we're going to blow past that deadline. So this morning, we're joined by the reporter who helped bring this story to our attention years ago now, and he's still covering it for us today. What do you want to know about Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake? What do you think about the reported abuse at Lincoln Hills and what it's done to recidivism rates in Wisconsin? And how do you think we should treat kids who break the law? We'll hear from you this morning at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us ideas at WPR.org. Patrick Marley, state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, has been covering this. When did you start covering this story, Patrick?
Oh, let's see. Must have been about 2017 that we learned about a raid on Lincoln Hills by a large group of law enforcement. That's really what kicked off our coverage of the problems that had been happening there.
And although we've had deadlines for their closures and we've heard the justifications why, the closures have not happened. And now this Northwoods Youth Prison remains open with incarcerated juvenile inmates. Why didn't the closure happen?
Well, you can put the responsibility for not closing that entirely on the politicians in Madison. They passed this bill. I mean, there was unanimous support for the idea of closing Lincoln Hills and establishing new regional facilities where incarcerated kids would stay. That way they'd be closer to their homes. You could have these in, you know, the Milwaukee and Southeast Wisconsin region, Madison. The bill didn't stipulate where they would be, but there was this process set out to build these. It turned out to be more expensive than the initial bill provided funding for. They recognized that very quickly. And so then there's been this ongoing discussion about how we fund it, how much we should spend on it, where we build them, and everything is just stalled. And so they passed a bill. When Evers said that they hadn't provided him enough time and he needed another more time to close it, Republican legislators said 6 months was the maximum. They wouldn't give him any more time than that, so they extended it from January to July. But they gave no additional funding. And so all sides recognize that, you know, you can't close Lincoln Hills until you have these new facilities, but we haven't made any progress on that. Beyond, there has been some expansion of the Mendota Juvenile Mental Health Facility, and that will take some of the kids who are at Lincoln Hills, but we need these other facilities. If we're going to go along with what the original plan was, we would need new facilities, and, you know, shovels haven't been put in the ground, sites haven't even been selected yet.
And there was nothing in the signed budget that would give us any notice that things would change regarding our youth prisons in Wisconsin.
No, they didn't address this in the budget.
Let's go to Steve from Rice Lake now at 1-800-642-1234. Steve, good morning. You're on with Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Yeah, good morning. So I work inside the prison system, and I'm just wondering, was there any discussion about the staffing shortages security-wise? I mean, we've got 25% to 40% staffing shortages in some of these adult institutions, and that combined with the fact that they've maxed out the wages at a 15-year rate. You know, you've got people like myself who've got almost a decade more than that, and we're being paid at a 15-year rate. I mean, how do they expect to fix that kind of stuff? Have they addressed any of that? I'll take my answer off the air.
And before you answer, Patrick, we've got another caller here, similar story, and perhaps we could put them together. Paul in Eagle River. Good morning. You're on the air with Patrick Marley.
Yes, sir. Thanks for my call. So my wife was a guard at Lincoln Hills for almost 2 years. The staffing is really, really poor there because of the amount of injured staff. Right now there's 25 staff members out on injured leave because of inmates injuring staff, and that never sees daylight. And she was working 100 hours a week sometimes.
Wow. How long ago was this, Paul?
2 years ago.
What was it like when she would come home from work? Give us an idea of what that work did to work-life balance.
Well, she was forced to work double shifts. Absolutely forced. So if you plan, you cannot plan anything. She would get done with her 8-hour shift. 20 minutes before her 8-hour shift was done, they said, you got to work another 8. So most of the time she ended up staying at a hotel down near the prison because she had a 45-minute commute every day. So to drive home and sleep 4 or 5 hours and then drive right back to work, because she had a couple of weeks that were 104 hours a week. And then she was injured on the job. She was slammed against a wall, and she had bulged discs in her neck. And when Governor Evers took over, they took away pepper spray, and the guards cannot literally defend themselves against the youth in the prison. They cannot touch them or anything.
Paul from Eagle River, Steve from Rice Lake, appreciate what you have to share this morning at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Patrick, back-to-back stories of understaffing, which is part of what you have covered at this youth prison.
Yeah, this has been a long-running problem at all of the state's correctional facilities. We've put a lot into the problems at Lincoln Hills with their staffing. What both of these guys describe is in keeping with what we've heard from lots of other people. It is, you know, prisons, unlike maybe other workplaces, if you have someone call in sick, if you just don't have a job filled, you can't just leave a post vacant. In most cases, you have to have someone there. If there are facilities that have to be staffed 24/7. So this does happen where workers, they expect to be called into a second shift. When their first shift is over, they're immediately put onto a second shift, so they have to work 16 hours. It's not happening just at Lincoln Hills. It's at all the adult prisons as well. There was a provision in the budget to give, a $5 hourly increase to those who work at the prisons with the biggest staffing shortages. So they're hoping that that will help increase some of their the problem at the places that have the worst issues. But the fact is there are staffing shortages all over the prison system in the state.
Patrick Marley, state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, breaking the story about Lincoln Hills, going back to the raids of 2015, when at that time, according to the Department of Corrections, Patrick, Lincoln Hills held 264 inmates. Do you know what the population is there now?
We're a lot down from that. I don't have the most current figures, but we're less than 100. And that is because and you're right, you mentioned that this all started in 2015. I guess it goes back a little further than I recall. the numbers have come down a lot for a number of reasons. Judges are less inclined to send them there. Counties are finding other places to put these kids. They might be able to have them in a setting that falls short of what's effectively a prison. And so there have been efforts to divert the numbers, which makes the ultimate problem easier to solve, right? If you have to find new facilities for 80 kids rather than 260 kids, that makes it easier to do.
Sure, but do we have any indication when the soonest we would see Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake closed?
You can give no timeline whatsoever because they haven't appropriated enough money for it. So, maybe we'll see a bill later this session. But whether that will advance, completely unclear. It's been just stalled for a couple of years now, and no one's really taken the mantle to try to find a way to solve it.
As you've been covering this story of Lincoln Hills, Patrick Marley, what's on the horizon and what are you looking for next?
Well, I guess I would want to see if in the remaining part of this session anybody tries to come up with a way to address this. It obviously didn't make it into the budget. There weren't really discussions of it in the budget. Beyond the governor, when he initially proposed this, he wanted to address this. The Republican lawmakers took that out. So the question is, does anyone put it forward now this fall? And if so, can they get some momentum for it? Or do we get, you know, caught up in an election year where Republicans don't want to give a win to the governor and they hold back on this, or they hold back for some other reason? They think that it's too expensive, or they've, you know, rethought how they want to house incarcerated youth.
Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake is a political hot potato as we move towards the election. We shall keep an eye on that with our guest from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Patrick Marley. Thank you as always.
Thank you.
Up next is news. Then the State Capitol Report continues with State Representative Janelle Branchen from Menominee Falls. She chairs the Assembly's Committee on Elections and Campaigns and recently visited Arizona to review an audit of the 2020 elections. That's when we continue following the news. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show, and I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. Our next guest is chair of the Wisconsin Assembly Committee on Campaigns and Elections, the vice chair of Government Accountability and Oversight, and the state representative for the 22nd Assembly District in Wisconsin. From Menominee Falls, Representative Janelle Branchen. And we invite you to join our conversation this morning with your questions. 1-800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Representative, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning. Welcome to you, Lee.
Thank you. And so you were recently among a group of state legislators who traveled to Arizona to witness an ongoing audit of the 2020 election results. Why did you go?
I think it was a great opportunity to see, you know, there's been so much in the media about what exactly was happening in Arizona. So it was a real privilege to be able to see what that actually meant.
And from what did you see?
You know, it's a very detailed process. It was a process of almost, 2,800 volunteers who had the opportunity over several months to go ahead and watch a recount in an audit process that really we've never seen before in this country. It was an opportunity for them to actually go through ballots and photograph if they had been indented or had the felt marker, have the opportunity to bleed through. So they were looking to see if there were copies or if there had actually been ballots that had been used by a marker or a ballpoint pen. They also had the opportunity to an incredible hand count process. And, you know, this is all available online, and it has been since the beginning. It was guarded, the whole process was guarded by the troopers there in Arizona. And, you know, I think it's that opportunity to bring sunlight, right? That's what we want to make sure, that our elections are fair and they're transparent. And that was the process that I think they're looking to make sure that there's sunlight to the process of having elections.
The Maricopa County Board, controlled 4-1 by Republicans, has denounced the audit. The Associated Press says Arizona has already conducted two audits. The Secretary of State of Arizona is now warning that observers are not allowed to be watching the audit or are not allowed in anymore. That was over the weekend. Is this a partisan audit?
Well, I don't know how you can have a partisan audit when you have so many volunteers being part of the process. The volunteers that have been in there and had the opportunity to work, which none of them are being paid, had to sign a non-disclosure. And I think the report is coming out fairly soon to have that opportunity to talk about what they have found. You know, the attorney general for the state has made it clear that they want to continue the process. And I don't know how it's really a partisan audit when you have cameras overhead 24/7.
So after visiting Arizona, WisPolitics.com has a headline about you calling for something similar in Wisconsin. What would that mean from your perspective?
Well, I think, you know, we do have an audit going on right now in the state of Wisconsin, and that has been going on since February. We've, you know, have a very clear team of auditors that provide all kinds of information on many subjects. I guess my concern is going into our audit that we make sure we bring sunlight to the whole process. you know, COVID in itself created a voting situation that we've never really had in 2020, right? We had so many absentee ballots because of COVID that it kind of exposed a couple of short-sighted things that we've had in a process for absentee ballots that was, you know, a few hundred, now became hundreds of thousands. So, you know, that goes back to the fact that, you know, ballot harvesting, curing ballots, you know, a uniform request for balloting, the indefinite confined issues. These are all the type of things that, unfortunately, we're going to be dealing with again in 2022, unless we have that opportunity, which we recently gave to the governor, to try to talk about these things, right? Let's make a very clear and transparent playing field going forward so that we don't have to deal with many of the inconsistencies that, you know, our Supreme Court didn't say it was right or wrong. They just said it was too late. So we should be dealing with this now. Our laws are very clear that we have 22 months to go through elections and that we have 22 months to go through the ballots and the tabulators and all of that information. So this is that opportunity to let people know that, hey, we're going to bring sunshine to it and it all makes sense.
So you're referencing the Legislative Audit Bureau and their ongoing audit of the 2020 election in Wisconsin. And would that is that what you were referring to when you returned to Arizona? Would that suffice for another audit of this election?
I think it's another opportunity. It's certainly been an ongoing. And the first one that was set up, since almost February, does that sound right, Lee?
Yeah.
That it's been, you know, going on and taking a look at the information. But, you know, between February and where we are today, you know, we haven't talked about, you know, CTCL, Civic Tech for Civic Life, which is, you know, another five lawsuits and complaints that we have in the state of Wisconsin. Another thing from 2020 that was different than any other election. And, you know, I don't know how much you've covered it, but having a New Yorker basically fly in from the National Vote at Home Institute and have keys to the counting room, have set up his own curing process against the will of the sitting clerk to create a situation of voting navigators, which I don't know what that is, and I don't know that it was ever defined, certainly not defined in law.
I'm sorry, Representative Branch, and I just want to make sure I'm following. You're referencing the Center for Technology and Civic Life, a contribution of over $6 million that went to five.
Almost 10. Yeah, almost 10 by the time the additional monies came through.
And that money was largely approved by the municipalities, as I understand it, correct? Which city clerk was did not want that money?
Well, I think, first of all, the money itself was put under a contract from to allow a 2020 safe voting plan. And if that 2020 safe voting plan wasn't followed, the money could be clawed back. And I think that alone should make everybody think, you know, for a minute, why they went to basically the five communities. Now, it did give money, CTCO did give money to other communities, but nowhere to the amount that we're talking about with Kenosha, Racine, Green Bay, Milwaukee, and Dane counties.
There were, as I understand, and I'm taking this from The Virus and the Vote, which is a compendium of research from Stanford and MIT that was put out on July 1st. There were two lawsuits for the Center for Technology and Civic Life that were adjudicated, one before and one after the election. It was former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Hagedorn who said that the plaintiffs came nowhere close to establishing their claims with facts. And you mentioned three other lawsuits that I'm unfamiliar with, Representative Branch, and what do you know about those?
Well, I think you're misquoting the current complaints that are out there right now for the five communities. And that was really because they had not gone through WEC first, the Wisconsin Elections Commission. You know, Wisconsin does have a procedure, and if it's not followed, certainly the courts have concerns. So, yes, all five of these communities are right now, all five are going forward with the concerns for CTCL and making sure that, listen, at the end of the day, do we want quid pro quo? Do we want the highest bidder to have the opportunity to put their own individuals, be it nonprofit, into the counting rooms. I mean, and yes, Green Bay had concerns. Those are certainly on my website if you want to go to it at Rep. Branchon. Has all the emails that we found in February about the clerk saying, no, I am not satisfied with your curing process. I've been the clerk for 20 years. I mean, these are the kinds of concerns that we should have going forward to make sure that that is one of the bills that we put on the governor's desk. And should third-party money, if we want to keep transparency, should third-party money be part of our election process?
We're talking with Wisconsin's rules for about Wisconsin's rules for elections with Republican State Representative Janelle Branchon of Menominee Falls, taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234, where Mary is standing by from Milwaukee. Mary, you're on the air with State Representative Janelle Branchon.
Good morning. Thank you, Representative. Since you want to be so transparent, I'd like to know how your trip was paid for from going to Arizona.
It was paid for by a third-party group? It was, I was there less than 24 hours.
Okay.
Was
interesting.
Wispolitics.com says Voices and Votes, a 501c4, which is run
nonprofit?
By...
nonprofit?
Yeah, which is run by the anchor, Christina Bob from One America News Network.
Yeah, I believe so. I couldn't tell you.
And, I've seen the video of Christina.
I mean, I don't know who their board is, but yeah. I think we were pretty transparent about it.
Okay. Any other questions, Mary?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Let's go to Steve from Stoughton now. Steve, you're on the air with State Representative Janelle Branchon.
Hi. Good morning. Look, during the whole election last year and the fiasco that ensued, I kept saying, why don't we have national standards? Why don't we have national standards? And here we are talking about a trip to Arizona to look at some fiasco audit. You know, why don't we have national voting standards?
State representative?
Well, the Constitution is very clear. It's states' rights. The states, remember, were called the United States. So states in Georgia, states in Florida have different voting laws. Wisconsin's are incredibly generous in the sense that compared to other states, in this state, you have the ability to show up and vote, register and vote on the same day, which is not really, many states don't have that. So we certainly want to make sure that it's easy to vote in the state of Wisconsin.
I want to get other questions in this morning, if available, 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest this morning is State Representative Janelle Branchon, who recently traveled to Arizona to find out about the third-party audit that has been going on since May. As you heard here, the Legislative Audit Bureau from the state of Wisconsin, a nonpartisan organization, is currently conducting their own audit, and the results are expected by fall. So if you have questions about what's next for our elections, your vote and your voice in Wisconsin, happy to handle those along with our guest this morning, State Representative Janelle Branchon. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. This is the State Capitol Report on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest is State Representative Janelle Branchon. I welcome your questions this morning about our elections and the power of partisanship and your voice, your vote. 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. And Representative Branchon, just from WPR News, they found that Wisconsin clerks reported 238 possible voter fraud cases dating back through 2016 throughout every election, including about 20 throughout the elections of 2020. What are your top concerns with those sorts of numbers about running elections in Wisconsin?
Well, I don't think that report is completely accurate because there have been, I think, 172 additional felons that had been part of the report that I think is still coming out. It does take a couple months for the ERIC process to compare people across states, people who have been maybe adjudicated. We have a couple of those cases, too. But, you know, this is really about making sure that we don't have a problem. Is there, you know, the opportunity to maybe look at the router logs to make sure that we don't have a situation where information did come in on the tabulators themselves. I mean, there's more to just going through and recounting the ballots we have. Was there an opportunity for ballots to maybe have some ballots that need to go through and be viewed again? So, like I say, it's a pretty in-depth process that really hasn't been done before, because a lot of it has to do with the fact that, listen, at the end of the day, the truth is the truth, right?
And well, facts are the facts.
Bringing sunshine to the process, you know, doesn't have to be painful. It really doesn't.
Do you have doubts about the 2020 results in Wisconsin?
With all of the issues that happened in the state of Wisconsin, look at the fact that WEC was unable to clear off their voter logs.
The Wisconsin Elections Commission. Sorry, I just...
And I appreciate that you keep on adjusting and making, explaining all of the acronyms. I apologize.
I understand completely.
No, I mean...
At the Capitol, it's a little bit different. I want to get some other callers in here join us. Patrick from Richland County. Good morning. You're on the air with State Representative Janelle Branchin from Menominee Falls.
Well, State Representative Branchin, thanks for showing up. I got a couple questions for you. You only have to answer one, though, whichever one you choose. Number one, you're implying, of course, that our county clerks who take care of the voting in all the counties and our neighbors who help them do it are either incompetent or can't be trusted. Number two, do you happen to know the number of cases that were thrown out of court on behalf of the Trump group challenging the election results across the United States? There were a ton of them, but do you know how many were actually thrown out of court when they challenged election results?
I don't know that answer, Patrick.
Yeah, it's over 50.
Yeah.
Okay.
Patrick, good morning to you. How are you? And I do show up to work every day, and I certainly take phone calls every day.
Right.
But absolutely, the question should be, I don't know, I think it's the number of 63, but I think the issue is that we need to make sure that what happened with the Supreme Court and others, they chose not to take it. Did you ever by chance read the dissent from the Wisconsin Supreme Court? And it was very clear from the justices, that it was a 4-3 vote, that said, we are not providing guidance. You're not providing the clarity on elections to make sure that people have confidence in the system. And I can't speak to, I haven't read the others, but I have read the one for the state of Wisconsin on a 4-3 vote. And the question then becomes, are we going to make guidance clear on many of these issues, ballot harvesting, curing ballots? Listen, this should be cut and dry as far as I'm concerned.
Well, one of the things
I'm
sorry, Jen. I don't mean to interrupt Representative Branchin, but I do want to ask while we have the time about Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. You're the chair of the Elections and Campaigns Committee in the Assembly. But Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is, as we've seen in the news, hired former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman to oversee an election review by retired police officers. Where do your calls for an Arizona style audit, as cited in the WisPolitics.com story, fall within the purview of what the Assembly Speaker is doing right now with a review of the 2020 elections?
Well, I think we can. Well, first of all, I'd like to answer his other question.
Oh, sorry.
If I don't trust our neighbors, and of course I do. Yeah. But you also are looking at a system where many of the clerks do let the programming to be done by third-party groups. Ballots are done by third-party groups. A lot of heavy decisions from WEC.
What do you mean ballots are done by third-party groups? Can you explain that, please?
Well, that's actually what was said by Megan Wolf, that ballots designed, I want to be real clear about ballot designs, can be done by third-party groups from the conversation that we had, because this group from New York, from the National Vote at Home, did come to the state of Wisconsin designing ballots, and that is things that they had put forward. I think there's some uncertainty about what ballot designs they had picked or not.
Who should decide how? It's a good question. Who should decide how our ballots formed? As there have been questions of don't forget to flip over your ballot, and you know where you end up on the ballot
certainly
can certainly cost you. So who should decide that?
Well, you know, and that is the nerd, right? That is the getting down to the details of making sure that everybody gets the opportunity to read it properly and that it's read properly on the edges, because that has a lot to do with
should
the coding, too.
Do you think the state legislature, in conjunction with the governor, should have some say in this measure?
I think the larger question is, should third-party groups have anything to do with this measure? I think it is the role of the clerk, because our law is incredibly clear about that, and that I don't know that I need a guy from New York to fly in and be able to be designing the ballots for the state of Wisconsin. I don't think that's necessary.
We're talking about Wisconsin's rules for elections with our guest, Republican State Representative Janelle Branchen of Menominee Falls, and your calls at 1-800-642-1234, where Mark in Fox City is standing by. Mark, you're on the air with State Representative Branchen. Good morning.
Good morning. I really think that it's important that we continue this great conversation about the importance of a valid and integrity-laden election process. Knowing that Wisconsin has been talking about fair maps and voter, people picking, candidates picking their voters, when will the Wisconsin legislature actually address fair voter maps? I know there have been a number of studies stating that the statistical probability of the number of Republicans elected doesn't make sense with the number of votes.
We've got limited time here, so State Representative Branchen, what about our redistricting in Wisconsin?
I think we're all waiting for the Biden administration to come forward with the census that's been held up.
So,
and, you know, at that point, we will certainly work with the governor to get maps that we can agree to.
Is there expectations that we will have redrawn lines for the 2022 elections?
Well, it's based on the census.
So are there expectations do you expect that we will redraw our congressional district lines, our voting lines, or will we be in different?
I have no power on that. That's something that we'll work with the governor. And you know, it's hard to have a conversation about that until you see the census numbers.
With the Legislative Audit Bureau's audit ongoing about the elections, with the Assembly Speaker's investigation with former Supreme Court Justice Gableman, and with your call for an Arizona-style election, what should voters in Wisconsin be watching for next, Representative Branchen?
Well, I think the point is for the next 22 months, although we're already 7 months into this, having the opportunity to go through the information we have, to continue looking at giving people the confidence that it's a fair and transparent election is part of the oversight that is necessary from the committee. And I'm certainly committed to making sure that we continue to bring sunlight to issues such as TTCL coming to the state of Wisconsin.
Free, fair, and transparent elections. State Representative Branchen, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
We completely agree with that. Thank you so much for your time.
Just ahead, we can use trees to fight extreme heat? No, that's not a question. That's a statement. Stay tuned. I'm Lee Rayburn. You've been listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network.